The Iliad, or The Poem of Force by Simone Weil. The true hero, the true subject, the center of the Iliad is force. Force employed by man, force that enslaves man, force before which man's flesh shrinks away. In this work, at all times, the human spirit is shown as modified by its relations with force, as swept away, blinded by the very force it imagined it could handle, as deformed by the weight of the force it submits to. For those dreamers who consider that force, thanks to progress, would soon be a thing of the past, the Iliad could appear as an historical document. For others, whose powers of recognition are more acute and who perceive force today as yesterday at the very center of human history, the Iliad is the purest and the loveliest of mirrors. To define force, it is that X that turns anybody who is subjected to it into a thing. Exercised to the limit, it turns man into a thing in the most literal sense. It makes a corpse out of him. Somebody was here, and the next minute there is nobody here at all. This is a spectacle the Iliad never wearies of showing us. The horses rattle the empty chariot through the files of battle, longing for their noble drivers, but they on the ground lay dearer to the vultures than to their wives. The hero becomes a thing dragged behind a chariot in the dust. All around his black hair was spread. In the dust his whole head lay, that once charming head. Now Zeus had let his enemies defile it on his native soil. The bitterness of such a spectacle is offered as absolutely undiluted. No comforting fiction intervenes, no consoling prospect of immortality, and on the hero's head no washed-out halo of patriotism descends. His soul, fleeing his limbs past to Hades, mourning its fate, forsaking its youth and its vigor. Still more poignant, so painful is the contrast, is the sudden evocation as quickly rubbed out of another world, the faraway, precarious, touching world of peace, of the family, the world in which each man counts more than anything else to those about him. She ordered her bright-haired maids in the palace to place on the fire a large tripod, preparing a hot bath for Hector, returning from battle. Foolish woman! Already he lay far from hot baths, slain by gray-eyed Athena who guided Achilles' arm. Far from hot baths he was indeed, poor man, and not he alone. Nearly all the Iliad takes place far from hot baths. Nearly all of human life, then and now, takes place far from hot baths. Here we see force in its grossest and most summary form, the force that kills. How much more varied in its processes, how much more surprising in its effects is the other force, the force that does not kill. That is, that does not kill just yet. It will surely kill. It will possibly kill. Or perhaps it merely hangs poised and ready over the head of the creature it can kill at any moment, which is to say at every moment. A man stands, disarmed and naked, with a weapon pointing at him. This person becomes a corpse before anybody or anything touches him. Just a minute ago he was thinking, acting, hoping. Motionless he pondered, and the other drew near, terrified, anxious to touch his knees, hoping in his heart to escape evil death and black destiny. With one hand he clasped suppliant his knees, with the other clung to the sharp spear, not letting go. Soon, however, he grasps the fact that the weapon which is pointing at him will not be diverted, and now, still breathing, he is simply matter. Still thinking, he can think no longer. Thus spoke the brilliant son of Priam in begging words, but he heard a harsh reply. He spoke, and the other's knees and heart failed him. Dropping his spear, he knelt down, holding out his arms. Achilles, drawing his sharp sword, struck through the neck and breastbone. The two-edged sword sank home its full length. The other, face down, lay still, and the black blood ran out, wetting the ground. If a stranger, completely disabled, disarmed, strengthless, throws himself on the mercy of a warrior, he is not, by this very act, condemned to death. But a moment of impatience on the warrior's part will suffice to relieve him of his life. Alone of all living things, the suppliant we have just described neither quivers nor trembles. He has lost the right to do so. No one saw a great Priam enter. He stopped, clasped the knees of Achilles, kissed his hands, those terrible man-killing hands that had slaughtered so many of his sons. The sight of a human being pushed to such an extreme of suffering chills us like the sight of a dead body. So Achilles shuddered to see divine Priam. The others shuddered too, looking one at the other. But this feeling lasts only a minute. Soon the very presence of the suffering creature is forgotten. He spoke. The other, remembering his own father, longed to weep. Taking the old man's arm, he pushed him away. Both were remembering. Thinking of Hector, killer of men, Priam wept, abased at the feet of Achilles. But Achilles wept, now for his father, now for Patroclus, and their sobs resounded through the house. It was not insensibility that made Achilles, with a single movement of his hand, push away the old man who had been clinging to his knees. Priam's words, recalling his own old father, had moved him to tears. It was merely a question of his being as free in his attitudes and movements as if, clasping his knees, there were not a suppliant, but an inert object. Pushed, they fall. Fallen, they lie where they are unless chance gives somebody the idea of raising them up again. But supposing that at long last they have been picked up and honored with cordial remarks, they still do not venture to take this resurrection seriously. They dare not express a wish lest an irritated voice return them forever to silence. He spoke. The old man trembled and obeyed. At least a suppliant, once his prayer is answered, becomes a human being again like everybody else. Such is the empire of force, as extensive as the empire of nature. Nature, too, when vital needs are at stake, can erase the whole inner life, even the grief of a mother. But the thought of eating came to her when she was tired of tears. Force in the hands of another exercises over the soul the same tyranny that extreme hunger does, for it possesses, and in perpetuo, the power of life and death. Its rule, moreover, is as cold and hard as the rule of inert matter. The man who knows himself weaker than another is more alone in the heart of a city than a man lost in the desert. Two casks are placed before Zeus's doorsill, containing the gifts he gives, the bad in one, the good in the other. The man to whom he gives baneful gifts he exposes to outrage. A frightful need drives across the divine earth. He is a wanderer and gets no respect from gods or men. Force is as pitiless to the man who possesses it, or thinks he does, as it is to its victims. The second it crushes, the first it intoxicates. The truth is, nobody really possesses it. The human race is not divided up in the Iliad into conquered persons, slaves, suppliants on the one hand, and conquerors and chiefs on the other. In this poem there is not a single man who does not at one time or another have to bow his neck to force. The common soldier in the Iliad is free and has the right to bear arms. Nevertheless, he is subject to the indignity of orders and abuse. But whenever he came upon a commoner shouting out, he struck him with his scepter and spoke sharply. Achilles himself, the proud hero, the undefeated, is shown us at the outset of the poem, weeping with humiliation and helpless grief. The woman he wanted for his bride has been taken from under his nose, and he has not dared to oppose it. But Achilles, weeping, sat apart from his companions, by the white-capped waves, staring over the boundless ocean. What has happened is that Agamemnon has deliberately humiliated Achilles to show that he himself is the master. So will you learn that I am greater than you, and anyone else will hesitate to treat me as an equal and set himself against me. But a few days pass, and now the supreme commander is weeping in his turn. He must humble himself. He must plead and have, moreover, the added misery of doing it all in vain. In the same way, there is not a single one of the combatants who is spared the shameful experience of fear. The heroes quake like everybody else. It needs only a challenge from Hector to throw the whole Greek force into consternation, except for Achilles and his men, and they did not happen to be present. He spoke, and all grew still and held their peace, ashamed to refuse, afraid to accept. But once Ajax comes forward and offers himself, fear quickly changes sides. A shudder of terror ran through the Trojans, making their limbs weak, and Hector himself felt his heart leap in his breast, but he no longer had the right to tremble or to run away. 2 days later, it is Ajax's turn to be terrified. Zeus, the Father on high, makes fear rise in Ajax. He stops, overcome, puts behind him his buckler made of 7 hides, trembles, looks at the crowd around like a wild beast. Even to Achilles the moment comes. He too must shake and stammer with fear. But with the exception of Achilles, every man in the Iliad tastes a moment of defeat in battle. Victory is less a matter of valor than a blind destiny, which is symbolized in the poem by Zeus's golden scales. Then Zeus the Father took his golden scales. In them he put the 2 fates of death that cuts down all men, one for the Trojans, tamers of horses, one for the bronze-sheathed Greeks. He seized the scales by the middle. It was the fatal day of Greece that sank. By its very blindness, destiny establishes a kind of justice. Blind also is she who decrees to warriors punishment in kind. He that takes the sword will perish by the sword. The Iliad formulated this principle long before the Gospels did, and almost in the same terms.